So, good morning. Once again, I'm Louisa May Alcott, and I want to thank you for Reverend Keller for choosing the hymn this morning, because hymn number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth, was a favorite mid-19th century Unitarian hymn. We sang it all the time when I was a kid, and if you watch, how many of you saw the movie with Winona Ryder, Little Women? That it was in the soundtrack. Not that I had a chance to see it because I was long dead, but it really, we learned it. Lord of all, to thee we raise this our hymn of grateful praise. But you know what? I really like Source better. It's sort of transcendentalist. So whoever did the lyrics over again, good job. Good morning. I want to thank your consulting minister this year and the Sunday Service Committee for the kind invitation to journey here from 200 years past. My unfortunate midlife demise was in 1888, where I lived my whole life in New England, the cradle of our American Unitarian faith. I was one you might know myself, a Unitarian, attending the imposing church on the town square in Concord, Massachusetts. A short, often really muddy walk from our famous Orchard House residence, me and my parents and my three sisters. Now, your minister told me that she had made several pilgrimages there in her lifetime. How flattering to see my girlhood home and imagine my growing up years, which was also the setting for Little Women. She regaled me recently with a story about her taking a train from Boston with a Seattle UU colleague. I understand you became one with your sister Universalist, that's why you're UU. I wouldn't have known that. And how she stole an umbrella because it was raining from the sanctuary of the Concord Church, intending to return it someday. And how, after trudging in a downpour to once again explore the nooks and crannies of our quaint cottage, they were turned away because there was a busload of Japanese teenagers promised a private tour that afternoon. How she insisted to the admissions clerk that two Unitarian women had come all that way in the rain and were not to be denied a visit. And guess what? They went ahead and went on the tour. I imagine this year, this past summer especially, was a banner one, not just for the so-named Alcott freaks who come to Concord every June to study me, but for the one-time tourist who came there. It is, after all, the 150th anniversary of the publication of my first best-selling novel, which is, not counting the swashbuckling penny serials and melodramas I produced before then to support my family, how amazing it was that it sold 2,000 copies in the first 2 weeks after it was published in September 1868. Also amazing, it has never gone out of print. How in the early years my work was compared favorably to literary luminaries like Hawthorne and Emerson. Emerson was another Unitarian who lived just up the same muddy road and across the street from us. How by the turn of the 20th century, I fell out of favor. Little Women fell out of favor when the male critics, one of whom said he would run screaming in the other direction rather than read this book. My books, which he dismissed as being written for children, written by a woman, and about women's lives. How it used to be regularly assigned in public school as some of the one of the readings, not so much anymore, because it is thought to be unappealing to boys, and boys need to be encouraged to read. So where does Tom Sawyer get you women? Still, it has been read and reread over these years by famous writers. In fact, it's been called the most beloved book of American women writers. My surrogate Joan March, the main draw, the main reason why this list of women I'm going to give you became writers at all. Novelists like Ursula Gwynn and Barbara Kingsolver, Jane Smiley, other figures like Bell Hooks and Anne Lamott and Gloria Steinem, who said she has read Little Women every year since she was 12 years old. And she's in her 80s now. And Margaret Atwood, I hear you're interested in Margaret Atwood these days. And who's that former welfare mom who wrote those stories? Harry Potter? Some people say there's a very famous character in Harry Potter that was taken directly from Jo March. And who would that be?
Hermione.
Hermione, yeah. And some men have loved it and lauded it. Teddy Roosevelt. Now that's an unlikely president. And Rudyard Kipling. And James Carville, who said it made him cry. Oh, and yes, there's the Broadway plays and the TV dramas, the opera, the movies, Kate Hepburn as Jo, June Allison as Jo, Winona Ryder as Jo, and one coming up by the director of Lady Bird with Meryl Streep as Marmee. Meryl Streep is my mother, Marmee. Well, enough of this bragging and defense. I want to spend the rest of my brief time sharing a letter to me from Reverend Keller. A most challenging one, I would say. But then what would I expect from a Unitarian sister in the 21st century? A letter to Louisa. Dear Louisa May Alcott. Now, already that's pretty formal because people called me Lou, especially my mother. It has become the custom, or at least an intermittent one, to write and read a letter from UU pulpits to an important Christmas figure some Sunday before December 25th. Mary or Joseph, for example, the three wise men, the infant Jesus himself, asking questions or sharing insights gained through their part in this old and enduring story. This year, given my choice, Reverend Keller wrote me, I picked you. After all, for millions of girls around the world, the first line of part one, chapter one of your uber-famous 19th century novel, Little Women, Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents, grumbled Jo lying on the rug, is like sacred scripture. The opening of a portrait of an impoverished but lively and remarkably resilient quartet of American girls growing up in New England in the depths of the Civil War. As one literary critic has observed, many readers have fantasized about being Tomboy Jo. A few about being Motherly Meg, or Beth, the shy and perfect one, or Amy, the prettiest, the most vain, the artist. In fact, there has seldom been an instance when I have mentioned this book in the company of other females, Reverend Keller said, when I haven't been asked which of the girls I wanted to be, not which I most admired or which I most identified with, no, which of the four March girls had I wished I was after putting the book down for the first time at 8 years old. First time I read it, in the form of a quickly dog-eared, pink-covered, easy-reading junior classic. How many of you read junior classics growing up? Yeah. Racing straight through it, loving every word, and then read and reread throughout my childhood and beyond, ever propelled to find out whether each of these girls would, despite the hardships that their family endured, find their dreams, marry their men, have their babies, make their music, do their art, write their books. I was captivated over and over again. And I swear I had no idea at the time that this most beloved book was written by a born Unitarian, a born Junitarian whose mother's father was a Sephardic Jew from the May Company, the May family. Bet you didn't know that. Look. Miss Alcott, I kind of tell you how many times I was asked whether I wanted to be Jo, the cosmetically indifferent, strong-minded, literary March girl who dreamed of being a famous author and scribbled her little stories and plays in the garret of that simple house in Concord, Massachusetts. But the truth is that as a girl, I did not want to cast my lot with a carelessly dressed young woman with a quick temper and a sharp tongue and restless spirit, as close to home as that description might have hit. Dear Louisa, I really wanted, desperately wanted to be dear, sweet Beth, the March daughter who becomes ill after caring for those needy neighbor children and tragically dies before she can even consider getting into any unladylike trouble at all. The perfect child. The notion of the ever-perfect child immortalized, especially in the character of Beth March, children who never need to be taught or reminded about selflessness because they were already utterly, inherently unselfish by nature, is another deeply engraved American Christmas myth borrowed from European Romantic philosophy and then imported by our own Unitarian forebears, like Margaret Fuller, and especially your father, Bronson Alcott. Bronson, sometimes called the most transcendent of all transcendentalists, was convinced that not only were children born with inherent spirituality and intuition and immediate knowing, he was certain they were all born righteous, born knowing right from wrong, born unselfish, born good, born with a capacity and willingness to just give up their Christmas goodies, as the sisters did in Little Women that harsh winter, and as Beth did her health and her young life to tend the needy and the sick. Adding to that the prevailing and still underlying Unitarian Christian heritage that surrounded you in the New England of your time, the belief in salvation by character, on achievement dependent on needs, not deeds, not creeds, within a society where, as one writer put it, God only helps those who help themselves and each other. So the important message Christmas time to you and your sisters, which you carried on in your own writing, since you never married. Somebody asked me that earlier when I was making the rounds. No, I never married. I did raise my sister's child after she died. Was even as children to adopt the character and follow the teachings of Jesus, to change your ways and become more Christ-like by the day. No surprise that your Christmas stories, now all in one place in a handsome collection, are very earnest, very instructive, filled with little homilies on accepting suffering, becoming more cheerful and self-controlling, awakening to our better selves. Stories, for example, like A Hospital Christmas, where the patients may do with a, quote, few skinny turkeys and six very small pies and one humble but well-chosen little gift apiece, unquote, and where afterwards they were gently lectured that, quote, the day on which most perfect began is a good day for them to make themselves readier to follow that divine example, unquote. Stories of hardship, lessons about goodness and happy endings, stories where children at least temporarily trade their own comfort for that of others less fortunate, where grown-ups are helped but are also expected always to help themselves. Like you, Louisa, who, when you had to accept the charity of others, when your own father failed you with his crazy dreams, the schools he opened and closed, that nutty commune he opened. Yet even as a young woman, knowing that you also had to seek exhausting, even dangerous work as an army nurse, scribbling your stock stories in the cold of night to earn your way in the world and support your mother and your sisters when your father failed them over and over. Louisa, we have spoken from this pulpit in years past how we, you, use transcendentalists and otherwise, have somehow ironically been responsible in large part, for good or ill, for much of the standard American Christmas sensibility and traditions. The first American Christmas tree, Unitarian. Some of our most beloved American carols, Unitarian, including It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, and the most familiar English language translation of O Holy Night, Unitarian. Along with these, the transcendentalist Unitarian notion of born perfect children rewarded for their continued moral goodness at Christmas time, and the particular Yuletide responsibility of those with money to be directly charitable to those less fortunate. Even then, even in the 19th century, a society with sharp differences between the rich or even comfortable and those who labored for them. There was at least a one time a year obligation to have some contact with these people in the form of gifts with those less privileged. Dear Louisa, your writing, in fact, your life in part, reflected just this, just what your sister writer, Harriet Beecher Stowe, described as the sick, sated, and tired prosperous folk who alleviated their malaise by finding people who had not been overstuffed with presents, people, she wrote, who could be counted upon instead to be grateful for the smallest trifles. A supply of what she unfortunately called unsophisticated subjects to practice on. In other words, the poor. There's some of this in the chapter in Little Women that we just saw, giving up their Christmas for this German immigrant family as they see the appreciative faces of the chronically deprived. So it was then, and so it can be now, a disconcertingly mixed moral bag, this annual acutely Unitarian holiday practice of charity, salvation by sometimes very conspicuous deeds. Listen, Louisa, listen, everybody, to the newspaper account of 1875 of a Christmas pilgrimage to New York's Randall Island, home to institutions for the mentally ill and the poor, by well-heeled and or prestigious delegates, including you, dear Louisa. You had by that time become a celebrity of sorts, a literary star. According to this account, you and your party first visited the municipal orphanage, then the children's hospital, and finally what we used to call homes for retarded children. At each stop, one newspaper reported you mingled with the little ones, giving each a doll and some candy, accompanying each gift with some kind greeting. You were very moved by the experience, as a lengthy letter to your family indicated. You were, you wrote, entranced by the children's gratitude, the sudden cries of delight, the outstretched hands, the cheers of rapture. You noted that this was, on the other hand, the very first Christmas you had spent without a family dinner or presents. But you observed that you felt you'd had a splendid feast nonetheless, seeing those poor babies wallow in their turkey soup, and that every gift you put in their hands came back to you in the dumb delight of their unchildlike faces trying to smile. Ouch! Ouch! There is something, my beloved Miss Alcott, disturbingly naive and patronizing about your relationship with the people that you encountered on Randall Island, the object of your, I am certain, or I hope I am certain, well-meaning benevolence. And yet, in fairness to you, at the same time, your sense of obligation to poor people did not end at Christmas. And while you expected people to raise themselves to an ever higher standard of behavior and believed fiercely that virtue was its best and own reward, you could see the larger issues of social injustice as well. As a daughter of one of Boston's first social workers, Marmy, you were, as were your Unitarian peers at the time, involved in ongoing work with those in need through community settlement houses and in the radical Christian gospel, social gospel movement, which looked at deeper and more basic issues like safe and humane workplaces and fair wages. Like now, I see all of this in you, Louisa, and that helps me understand who you were and what your legacy is to us. I see you. So as we move towards Christmas Day, the coming of hope and peace within each one of us, let's celebrate our Unitarian, our thoroughly Unitarian Christmas, trim our thoroughly Unitarian trees, sing our Unitarian carols, and let's practice our Unitarian charity, but tempered with self-awareness and discernment as to whether it's patronizing or whether it's respectful. Let's look also for the precious perfection of our children, journey with them, and keep this alive. Louisa, you believe that the path from self to selfishness, selflessness, is the path to happiness. All who follow it, you told us, may experience the joy, the true joy of Christmas. May it be so this day. Your faithful and devoted literary fan, Marty.